She shampoos my locks. Always have my back, she stand true to that. Real type of loving, thank you for that. Yo, run barefoot without my shoes and socks. Cause she keep herself clean, man, I got catch no rush. And she love me for real, man, I feel you have no cash. And any little thing, and from a splish, she splash. Yo, all this blinging is like you forgot. Use cheddar as the bait, then you recruit the rat. So we listen, couple speech of Martin Luther chat. Then it's Brown, Bob Marley, and some super cat. Yo, it seem like she live upside the Duke of Shop. Cause she don't have a scratch, it's only beauty spot. When one duty start is when one duty stop. 1 9 to 5, 1 5 to 12 o'clock, you see me? Remember when we met and we began dating, and everything was couple set and we began mating. And then the women of our Gucci give me down ratings. Me come style and plenty full and I know one waiting. And she get her belly full and I know part scrapings. And the closer we become, the more she gravitating. Until we buckle down and there is no escaping. Now we typically become an everyday thing. Regularly physically communicating, sexually scientifically penetrating, until she starts spiritually resonating. As a man, no, she real and says she are no plating.
tease, the only thing the king is designating. As I'm a seal the deal, I am negotiating. I know it's kinda deep, but keep on concentrating. Cause just a little beat and I am clearly stating.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
In celebration that it's just over 30 years that Nirvana released their iconic Nevermind album, WRCT is pleased to present an extra rare interview Nirvana did back in 1992 with Kurt St. Thomas, the music director of WFNX in Boston. Let's check it out.
Here, say hi really loud. Ready? On three. Ready? Go. That's my sister.
I punctured every speaker in the cabinets, and there were 12 speakers to puncture. Really, I can't think of anything better to do than to puncture speakers. That's my favorite piece of equipment to destroy. It's a lot of fun.
I had Kurt's guitar cabinet. Like, I was smashing it, picking it. These things are heavy. Smashing it onto my bass drum, trying just to completely crack and destroy the bass drum, and it wouldn't do it. I was wailing on it with guitars. I was throwing it off of the riser as high as I could. Drums are hard to break.
Well, at first I wanted to be in a rock band when I was really young, and I decided about third grade that I wanted to be a stuntman. So, oh, heck yeah, Evel Knievel was a big influence on that. I'd jump my bikes, and I took all the bedding and pillows out of our house and put it on the deck and got up on top of the roof and would jump off. And I took a thin piece of metal one time and duct taped it to my chest and put a bunch of firecrackers on it and lit them on fire.
Buzz Osborne, guitar player from the Melvins, he, like, discovered punk rock. And he was turning people onto it. I heard it, and it sounded live to me. And then I borrowed the record, Generic Flipper, and I listened to it, and it was like a revelation. It was like, wow, it was just heavy. It was art. I was affected, and I've never been the same since. It was like a breakthrough.
I was 15 when I got my first guitar. My mother had just gotten married. This was in the first year of her marriage. My stepfather went out on her, and she got so irate that she took all of my stepfather's guns, various guns, pistols and rifles and stuff, walked down to the river and threw them in. And then I hired this kid to fish a couple of them out, and I sold them, and then I got my first guitar with the money. Oh, yeah, I took lessons for a week. I learned how to play Back in Black by AC/DC. And it's pretty much the Louie Louie chords, so that's all I needed to know. I never did pay the guitar teacher for that week either. I still owe money. But that's it. And then I just started writing songs on my own. Once you know the power chord, you don't need to know anything else.
Aberdeen's basically just small town America. It's about 100 miles southwest of Seattle. It's on the Pacific Ocean. Its main industry is logging and forest products. There's really no roads going through there. It's just kind of off the beaten path, off the beaten track, and things just kind of change, come slowly to Aberdeen. Everything revolves around the logging industry there. It's all logging. If the logging stopped, that'd be a ghost town.
Aberdeen, Washington, 1987. Nirvana was formed between singer-guitarist Kurt Cobain and bassist Chris Novoselic. Chris explains the birth of the band.
A little social group came together and we just kind of hung out and, you know, talked about things. And then one thing led to another, and Kurt did a tape with Dale Crover from the Melvins. One of the songs on it was Spank Through, and he turned me on to it, and I really liked it. It kind of got me excited. It's like, well, hey, man, let's start a band. We scrounged up a drummer and we started practicing. Took it very seriously, too.
I can feel it. I can hold it. I can really, I can see it.
The band recorded their first demo tape with Dale Crover of the Melvins.
He played on our first demo, and a couple of those songs made it over to the Bleach LP, Floyd the Barber and Paper Cuts. We jammed for about a week, put some songs together, and made this tape.
Kurt and Chris then enrolled Chad Channing to become Nirvana's first full-time drummer.
Chad wanted to express himself in a way that really didn't gel with the band. Chad really compromised his style to suit the band. I don't think he was happy doing that. And it was a good departure, you know. It worked well for everybody.
Good Lord, bless and keep you. Bye now.
Ready to do a twist, a surf, a wild watusi, a frug, or a swinging holly golly.
In December of 1988, Sub Pop Records released a limited 1,000 copies of Nirvana's first single, Love Buzz, a shocking blue cover with the B-side Big Cheese. Months later, in June of 89, the first Nirvana album, Bleach, was released. Kurt, Chris, and Chad recorded the album for $600 with producer Jack Endino. Jason Everman is also listed on guitar, but he didn't actually appear on the album, only on the tour. Kurt on Bleach.
Bleach just seemed to be really one-dimensional. It just has the same format. All the songs are slow and grungy, and they're tuned down to really low notes. And I screamed a lot. But at the same time that we were recording Bleach, we had a lot more songs like About a Girl. In fact, Polly was written at that same time, too. It's just that we chose to put the more abrasive songs on the Bleach album. So it really wasn't a matter of evolving within just a year, you know. We've always liked pop music and have always had a few songs like that.
That's About a Girl, recorded live Halloween night, 1991, in the city where Nirvana now calls home, Seattle, Washington. After the release of Bleach, the band went on its first national tour, and they were gearing up to record their second album. Chris explains.
We went to Madison, Wisconsin to record a record with Butch Vig in the spring of 1990. We laid down about 6-7 songs, which was like Lithium in Bloom.
Polly.
Oh, Dive. B-side of Sliver made it out. Stay Away. Anyway, we went there in the spring to record a record, right? Right after we finished recording the record, we went on this about 8-week tour of the U.S., starting in Madison. We got as far as New York, and everything was geared up to, you know, put out this second Nirvana record. We were going to record maybe a few more songs in Seattle.
This was going to be on Sub Pop,
right? This was going to be Sub Pop. This was going to be our second record, right? It was supposed to come out probably September of 1990. And, well, once we got off that tour, that's when we lost Chad. So there's uncertainty with that. We didn't want to release it. If we wanted to do anything, we wanted to do it with a new drummer. Sub Pop was doing some wheeling and dealing. They were going to sign a licensing deal with a big label, and that kind of scared us. And there were so many variables to consider that it wasn't wise to put out a record at all. We went and we toured the UK, and we went and toured Western Canada. And next thing you know, we were talking to labels ourselves, so that was just like... And
with Chad leaving the band, Kurt and Chris then enrolled friend and Mudhoney drummer Dan Peters. But Dan only lasted one gig.
Well, yeah, and it was a great gig, too. It was at the Motorsports Garage in Seattle. There was about 1,500 people there. Or no, there was a lot more people there. There was a lot of people there. And we just recorded a Sliver single with them a couple weeks before, and he was looking like he was going to be in our band, and that was just another case of compromising his style for our band. You know, he was going to go out and buy a bigger drum set, and you know, you can really hear his style. It's just Mudhoney, you know, those snare rolls. And well, you know, that's when the future of Mudhoney was uncertain. Steve wanted to go to school, and there was all this. It was just like, are Mudhoney going to break up? And Dan saw opportunity to join our band. A certain thing. So we're like, yeah, we love Dan as a person and we love his drumming. Well, it just goes back to that it was uncertain, and if Dan would have joined our band, it would have been certain that Mudhoney was finished, and we didn't want to be responsible for that.
Enter Dave Grohl, not just another drummer.
He's the most well-adjusted boy I've ever met. He's totally easy to get along with. Everyone loves him. He plays drums better than any drummer I've ever heard. I mean, he blows away John Bonham. If I had the choice of like bringing John Bonham back to life or to choose of any drummer of any band I couldn't even think of, they wouldn't be better than Dave. He's great.
He's great. Yeah, he's the backbone of the band.
Dave was playing in the Washington D.C. band Scream when things fell apart. Dave explains.
In 1990, we were on tour, doing a tour of America, and we were halfway through the tour in Los Angeles.
Their tour made it as far as Los Angeles, and their bass player flew the coop.
We got stranded there. There wasn't really much to do, and I called my friend Buzz Osborne, who is a singer for the Melvins. We'd known each other for a while.
Mutual friend of Kurt and Chris.
Yeah. He's actually the one that introduced them to each other. And he ended up introducing me to the band. And he just said that they were looking for a drummer and that they saw Scream play in San Francisco and thought I was really good, blah, 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 no romantic story.
We were just blown away by the whole band, especially the drummer. The drummer was really good.
I called him up.
When he called up, we're like, yeah, man, come on up.
The strangest thing about it was moving up to the Northwest with no money and nothing. I mean, I'd still only have like a bag of clothes, and I have drums. I bought a bed a couple months ago, so I have a room with this futon on the floor. But, I mean, I don't have anything, so I didn't really have to move. And just, you know, moving up, leaving your best friends in the world.
Yeah, it was weirder for him, probably, because he's kind of homesick, you know?
I mean, I didn't know Chris or Kurt, and I ended up living on Kurt's couch for 8 months.
And just packed up his stuff and came to Washington State.
I had every misconception that everyone else had, you know?
Sure.
All I thought Seattle was like, flannel shirts and blurry Charles Peterson photos, you know?
Lived in this little cracker box hellhole of an apartment, and I'm quite a slob, as you can see.
If you had someone that you did not know come and move into your apartment And you were sort of like, you felt this responsibility, like, okay, we must get along.
But it was kind of hard for two people to live in this really small apartment with one bedroom and just garbage all over the floor. A lot of corn dog sticks laying around.
Whatever, like a month or two, we were out in the backyard shooting stuff with BB guns and breaking windows at the lottery building across the street. It was fun. It was great. That apartment was great.
It was nice because Dave turns out to be just as much of a slob as me.
That's Aneurysm, the B-side of Smells Like Teen Spirit, recorded live. We'll be back with more of Nevermind, It's an Interview, right after this.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Nevermind, It's an Interview. With Nirvana's lineup now set, Kurt, Chris, and Dave began rehearsing.
We'd been practicing in this really weird practice space. This man built a studio in his in this like barn in his backyard, but it wasn't a barn. It was this thing that had a studio in it, and then upstairs, his brother lived up there, and he was in this really bad like Howard Johnson's lounge band. Everything is carpeted with this like brown shag carpet, and he even had stage lights in there. And he had a massive PA that he just did not know how to use. And you turn it on, and it was just this huge hiss, and we were practicing a lot, and we were writing a lot of material. We'd write them, they were great, for like 2 weeks, oh my god, this is the best song ever, and we'd forget them. And so then we decided, okay, well, we'll start putting them on cassette. So we started recording them onto these boombox things, and we'd lose the cassettes, you know. And so, I mean, we wrote so much material that we just like forgot about, and every once in a while we'll like pull one out and turn it around.
While the band was writing and rehearsing, the major labels started taking interest.
They were wining and dining us, and there were some labels we were impressed by them, but we thought DGC would be the best for us.
Was one of the main reasons because of Sonic Youth?
Yeah, we knew Sonic Youth were happy on there, and we always loved and respected Sonic Youth, so. And there's like all these rumors that we got like $1 million or 700. It was actually even in Spin magazine it was printed that we got $750,000, and we didn't even get a quarter of that. What we did was, instead of going for the big dough, we went for the strong contract,
which enables you like more freedom and
more percentage points on the record. And there's a lot of clauses in there that are in our favor. Now if our record would have bombed, we would have kicked ourselves in the butt and said, man, we should have took the cash. But we're not in it for the money. We were in it for, you know, let's put out a record and let's do this thing right. I like it.
I really don't know what the definition of selling out is anymore. I guess I really don't care. We haven't compromised. A record label lets us do anything we want. We think on the same level. There's nothing that we've done that could be considered a sellout at all, at least not in my eyes. A lot of people who are calling us sellout, they forget that, you know, the Ramones and the Sex Pistols were on major labels. So it was the Clash, and all those bands are trying to become big stars. They didn't even deny it. Crap, the Ramones had a movie out after them, you know, to help support them.
You know, I think if you make money and you start voting Republican because you'll get tax breaks and they're the party of the rich, I mean, that's sold out.
In early 1991, Nirvana entered the studio with producer Butch Vig.
Yeah, we worked with him in the springtime when we did that demo that I mentioned earlier. He was just easy to work with, laid back, and really attentive to what's going on. He works hard, but he doesn't work the band hard.
It was about time that the band recorded something. Finally, it had been so long.
It's called Sound City, and the board and the room are really old. The board is from the early 70s.
All the dinosaurs have recorded there. Fleetwood Mac, Cheap Trick.
There's nothing more disgusting than the late 80s or early 90s slick sound. You know, you just can't escape it. No matter how retro and old you try to be, or what kind of old equipment you use, you still can't help but sound new.
We got a warm sound out of that place.
It had been 2 years since Bleach. It had been a while since the band had gone in and recorded a full LP, so it was more of like, wow, okay, we're in the studio, let's just get this done, let's just do it.
We made the record we wanted to make. We didn't want to make the number one record. We didn't want to make some big hit record. We just, you know, it would have been the same record if it was on Sub Pop. One day!
We'll be right back. That's Drain You, recorded live. Kurt and Dave talk about writing songs.
It's usually done on acoustic guitar, sitting around in my underwear, just picking out riffs, pieces of songs.
Maybe Kurt will come in with a melody, a guitar riff, and show it to us.
We go to practice, and then we play the song over and over and over again.
We just jam. There's no real formula.
Chris and Dave have a big part in deciding on how long a song should be and how many parts it should have. So I don't like to be considered as the whole songwriter, but I do come up with the basis of it. I come up with the singing style during practice, and then I write the lyrics usually minutes before we record. That song really wasn't even written until a week before we went into the studio. And I knew I wanted cello on it, but after all the music was recorded for it, we'd kind of forgotten about putting a cello on it. And we had one more day in the studio, and we decided, oh, geez, we should try to hire a cellist, you know, and put something in. And we were at a party, and we were asking some of our friends if they had any friends who played cello, and it just so happens one of our best friends in L.A. plays cello. So we took him into the studio on the last day and said, here, play something, and he came up with something right away. It just fell like dominoes. It's really easy.
Something in the way. Something in the way. Yeah.
The lines in the song are really contradictory. You know, one after another, they're kind of a rebuttal to each line, and they just kind of confusing, I guess. It's just about people and what they're expected to act like.
Come as you are, as you were, as I want you to be.
Just because I say I in a song doesn't necessarily mean it's me. A lot of people have a problem with that. It's just the way I write usually. Take on someone else's personality or character. I'd rather just use someone else's example because, I don't know, my life is kind of boring. So, you know, I just take stories from things that I've read and off of television and stories I've heard and maybe even some friends.
All he wants a cracker. Think I should get off her first.
Obviously, I don't like rednecks. I don't like macho men. You know, I don't like abusive people, and I guess that's what that song is about. It's an attack on them. This friend of mine and I were goofing around in my house one night, and we're kind of drunk, and we were writing graffiti all over the walls of my house, and she wrote, Kurt smells like Teen Spirit. And earlier on, we were kind of having this discussion on revolution and teen revolution and stuff like that, and I took that as a compliment. I thought that she was saying that I was a person who could inspire. I just thought that was a nice little title. And it turns out she just meant that I smelled like the deodorant. I didn't even know that deodorant existed until after the song was written.
My father said this to me. I know why you guys have sold so many records. The video shows a bunch of kids trashing a gymnasium. And I mean, that sort of works. Like a Nirvana spokesman of the lost generation. They're telling you to go out and destroy your local gymnasium. I don't see it that way. I mean, like, I don't want to hold the responsibility of being a spokesman for anything. You know, I can barely hold my own. I guess it's flattering, and I guess it's great that it actually sort of gives people a feeling of sort of like breaking out and telling anyone and anything just to fuck off.
So high, I'm scratching up and love myself, better than you, but knowing it's wrong.
That's On a Plane, recorded live. Kurt talks about the artwork on Nevermind.
One day, Dave and I were sitting around watching a documentary on babies being born underwater, and we thought that was a really neat image. So we thought, let's put that on the album cover. And then when we got back a picture of a baby underwater, I thought it would look nice for a fish hook with a dollar bill on it. And so the image was born. It's just a rubber monkey that I've had for years. And I took that picture. I was in a Bohemian photography stage, you know, taking a bunch of weird arty pictures. That's one of them. It's a collage that I made many years ago. I got these pictures of beef from a supermarket poster and cut them out and made a mountain of beef, and then put Dante's people being thrown into hell, climbing all over it. And that's pretty much it. There's also, if you look real close, there's a picture of Kiss in the back, standing on a slab of beef.
"13 minutes and 51 seconds after the beginning of track 12, the band put a secret song on the Nevermind CD. This mystery song didn't make the first pressing, though. Dave explains.
When we got our first CD and popped it in, we listened to it. Oh, let's check to see if the track is there. And it wasn't there. The reason for it, I think the original reason, was because Something in the Way is sort of like your slower whatever song. It's the last song on the record and most likely to be listened to by, like, someone that would have, like, a carousel CD player. And so, okay, why not, like, just screw up their little carousel deal? I was talking to a friend who works in a record store, and he said, a person came in with the CD and said, you know, this thing's screwed up. After the last song, there's like this 10 minutes of dead space, and then this Total Noise song. He wanted his money back. And the person at the stores said, well, I think maybe it was a joke of the band, you know, put it on after. I guess, well, I don't think it's very funny, you know, and he wanted his money back. It was just like,
in a moment, we'll find out what's ahead for Nirvana when Nevermind, It's an Interview continues.
Do you remember what Top 40 radio sounded like back in the 1970s? Yeah, we don't either, but Jay Thurber might say, okay, Gen Xer, and tune into Radio 9 from noon until 3 p.m. each and every Saturday for your mix of oldies, newies, and maybe a little bit of snark. It's right here on Independent Freeform Radio 88.3 WRCT.
Welcome back to Nevermind, It's an Interview. Inspiration comes in many forms, and for Nirvana, it came in the form of an obscure Scottish band called the Vaseline's.
Kurt and I were totally into the Vaseline's. I mean, they were my favorite band. They still are one of my favorite bands.
Definitely our number one favorite band.
We finally got to play with them. They reformed to play with us when we played Edinburgh, Scotland in early winter of 1990. So we met Eugene and kind of kept the rap going with them. Then we heard Captain America, the band. We heard the tape. We're totally blown away.
Yeah, that's his new band, Captain America. They're really good.
Eugene's a great songwriter. So, like, yeah, Captain America's got to go on tour with us. Since our record has done so well, we can open up doors for other bands from where we come from, like Sonic Youth or Mudhoney or the Melvins or L7 or Dinosaur Jr. I can just go on and on and on and on.
I guess the best part would be being in the position to take other bands whom you like a lot on tour with you. It's definitely a nice thing to be able to do. We took Shonen Knife, a three-piece all-girl Japanese band, on tour with us in England, and they've been a favorite of ours for years, and no one really knows who they are in England or anywhere in Europe. And we've taken the Melvins on tour with us, and in the future we hope to take Hole and Jesus Lizard and a bunch of other bands who we like. but nothing really exciting happens on tour. People think that the rock star life is so exciting, but it's, you know, you play a show. You usually get into the town by the time it's dark, and you sound check, and you don't get to see the city. You play the show, and then you leave the next morning. You know, you go to the hotel room, and you leave, and do the same thing over and over again. It's kind of boring, in a way. I mean, still, I can't think of anything else I'd rather do, but it's not as exciting as everyone thinks. But it's getting harder for me to jump out of the audience now because the crowds are bigger, and some of the people don't realize that. I don't know what they realize, actually, because they're putting their hands in my pockets and trying to steal my money in my wallet, and they're hitting me really hard and scratching me. So after a while I'm probably not gonna be able to do it anymore. That's too bad, because it's a fun little bonding thing to do with the audience.
That's School, from the album Bleach, recorded live. Nirvana says their next album will be different, perhaps even more like Bleach.
Well, our next record's going to be different. It's going to be way different.
Well, I wouldn't want to put out two of the same record.
We'd like to record every song differently.
These are just ideas that we have. You know, I know it's going to be a record of extremities.
I think we had our shot at doing the big studio, high-tech Hollywood thing, whatever, you know. I mean, that studio to us was, like, pretty, like, techno. I don't know, maybe we'll do the next record on 8-track.
That will be recorded on 8-track.
You can get more low-end frequencies out of an 8-track.
Go back to the Bleach sound.
Back to that, sort of more along the lines of Bleach.
Because I really like the production of Bleach, and I don't know, I felt kind of weird straying so far away from it.
We got this far with this record.
There's definitely going to be some more abrasive songs on the next record.
You know, we're going to do something, just totally test the limits.
Really raw and abrasive to very pretty and candy-ish.
All the radio listeners or the MTV watchers or whoever, just like really test them and shove something totally aggro in their face and, you know, see if they can handle that.
Almost anything that's musical is pop music, as far as I'm concerned. As long as it's good and it's catchy, it's pop. Yeah, and a lot of punk rock is pop. I think the only time that punk rock strayed away from pop was when hardcore came around, you know, and there was a lot, you know, real dirgy stuff also, like the crossover metal thing, and I really can't consider a lot of that music.
You know, maybe 1% of the people who are listening to Nevermind, or they're bought Nevermind, or maybe not 1%, but I'm just saying this, a small minority of the people who are listening to our record now know about punk rock. A lot of people don't know about punk rock. They think of punk rock and they think of, like, that Quincy episode where the guy threw the brick off the building. And
I guess, I don't know, I just don't agree with the old punk rock ethos of, like, you have to starve to be a real artist. It's bullshit. We don't like to think of ourselves as a political band because, you know, you tend to become too anal and it becomes ridiculous if you shove it down people's throats. You know, we just ask people to be aware a little bit, and I think the songs kind of reflect that.
It's just another issue, another topic. Like, we could talk about racism, we could talk about feminism, nationalism. I don't really subscribe to that way of thought at all.
There's just so much corruption going on with the government, and the Reagan years have definitely set us back to where the average teenager feels kind of lost and there isn't much hope. They're still at least aware of the mistakes that our parents' generation has made. And I just think that it'll take a little bit of time for kids to start doing the duties that they're supposed to do, which is challenge things like corruption.
The way Americans' money is budgeted by our government, it leaves nothing to the education system. Teachers are dealing with the future, you know. Teachers are dealing with kids growing up who are going to take care of me or you someday. Just the education system in general in a lot of places is really screwed.
You know, it's great to get information like that so you can form your own ideas. It'd be neat if, like, you know, the 60s had a, like, Abbie Hoffman or a John Sinclair, you know, Timothy Leary to an extent. And they were spokespeople, and they were shaking things up. And nowadays, there's not really anybody.
Come on, people now! Smile on your brother! Everybody get together! Try to love one another right now!
Territorial Pissings, from the multi-platinum release, Nevermind. Since its release, the album has topped the Billboard charts, and the first single, Smells Like Teen Spirit, has become a top 10 hit. The success of Nevermind has taken a lot of people by surprise, including the band.
I'll never get over the shock, and that's kind of good.
It was sort of a really, whatever, organic thing. There wasn't any massive hype.
I mean, there was definitely no big million-dollar investment in promotion behind this record at all. It's totally organic, and it just happened.
You know, whatever's happened was surely out of our control, and I'm glad it happened. You know, it's nice to sell that many records. It's nice to turn on people as something different. People telling me, oh, yeah, you guys' record, I think you guys are going to go platinum. We're like, oh, man, come on. You know, if we get a gold record out of this, that'll be amazing.
It's not my fault. I've never wanted the fame involved. That's a totally different story. I think Paul Stanley said something like, the only thing that money gives you is relief of not having to worry about money. The only thing I'd really like to do with it is to invest in some bands that I like. I don't want to start my own record label. God, I know I couldn't do that. But I'd like to give some money to some labels who are putting out great music, help them that way. And probably going to buy a house. Hopefully we can have a recording studio too, a little 8-track recording studio so we can make good demos. Those are pretty much the plans. I should get some new shoes.
Yeah.
That wraps up an interview as done by Kurt St. Thomas of WFNX out in Boston back in 1992 with the members of Nirvana shortly after the release of the Nevermind album, which is celebrating over 30 years. You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. We've got more great music coming up next.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. Call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. This is a show called Viva La Mock. My name is Paul. People call me the Mockster, and thank you for hanging in there and listening. We're at that point of the day, the evening, the hour, where we do a thing called the mock. We take a word, artist, performer, some sort of theme, and play a bunch of cover songs or tribute songs or something that relates to what I'm calling the mock. Before I get into the mock, I do want to remind you that Attic Records joined you in supporting WRCT. Attic Records, they're located in Millvale, and they're open 7 days a week. They provide new and used records, it's in their name, and CDs. You know, from metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all those stops in between. Now, here's the deal. They pay for quality used records and CDs with no collection too big, no collection too small. You can visit them in Millvale or call them up at 412-821-8484. That is family-owned and operated Attic Records in Millvale. All right, I just jumped right into my background music because I didn't tell you who my mock theme was. It's Dwight Yoakam. Dwight Yoakam going underneath the mock light tonight. So I've got a half dozen songs Dwight wrote. Some other people decided to cover. So I'm going to start everything off with a cover of Please, Please, Baby by Big Kitty and the Scaredy Cats. The Viva La Mock radio program.
Please, please, baby. Baby, come back home. It's so cold.